It's the Burt Cohen Show. And what kind of dream is it that is going on? What kind of America is it? Is it one with the central powers have all the power? They're subservient to the central corporate powers? Or maybe the future looks a little bit different. And of course, the future is up to young people. You know, not us old geezers, myself, but there's a group called the Millennials now, who I'm not sure exactly what makes up the Millennials, but they're younger people. Millennials in 2012 are the group that put President Obama over the top. It was their percentage of the vote that was exactly his margin of victory. And our guest today is Benjamin Dominick, or I hope I pronounced that right, publisher of The Federalist. And Ben, you write that this group is absolutely essential for the Republicans to have any chance in 2016 and to be a relevant party into the future. Ben, thanks for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show.
Great to be with you, and thanks for having me on.
Well, let's define terms, first of all. Who are the millennials? What is the millennial generation?
So you'll hear slightly different definitions of this, partially because the actual boomlet of births that started for the children of the baby boomers really started around 1982, not 1980. But typically you see generations in sort of even two-decade periods. And so millennials are typically considered people born between 1980 and 2000. And in terms of the size of the generation, they are the largest generation in American history. They're larger than the baby boomers by a pretty significant amount. It's typically assessed by about 95 million compared to about 78 million. And in terms of their political activity, obviously they're only just becoming awake. You know, the oldest millennials are 34, and then you have, you know, a ton of younger millennials who are just entering their teenage years. And in terms of the politics that they've shown in the past, as you noted, they've been big supporters of President Obama. They certainly were in 2008 and in 2012. But what you see when you look across them as a generation today is a number of different factors, particularly a high degree of disappointment in President Obama and in large institutions generally, particularly the government. Part of that, I think, is feeling the false promise that of politicians who maybe overpromised on what they could deliver. But I think also it's the current climate and the current realities in terms of the economy that are really leading them to be skeptical of what they see in terms of what government can offer. What's interesting about this generation, there are a number of things that are interesting about it, but what's particularly interesting to me is the degree to which they've delayed a lot of the things that we think of as being the typical paths of adulthood. Not just the idea of going through college and then entering the workforce, which has proven difficult for so many of them, but also in moving out of their parents' houses, in terms of finding a mate, in terms of settling down and raising a family, moving out from cities into suburbs, things of that nature. It's all basically been something that's been a pressed pause sort of button since the beginning of the economic downturn. And it's really an open question now whether once the economy is able to come back, assuming that it's able to in the future, that for these millennials that they would actually pursue those kinds of lives, especially considering that those are the types of life patterns that have in the past led people to consider voting for conservative or Republican candidates, in the sense that, you know, once you move out to the suburbs, suddenly you start caring about property taxes.
Right.
Once you have kids, you start caring about what they're being taught in school and what's in the culture. And I think that that's really an open question now about whether millennials are going to take that path or whether they're going to pursue sort of a different direction. And that's something that I think really could define the way that this generation impacts our politics and our political scene for basically the next 30 years.
Wow, interesting. You know, it does remind me actually of my generation, which was also a fairly big generation, the baby boomers. After the, you know, the fun times of the late 60s, people had to get jobs, settle down, and probably most of us did become fairly conservative. And I guess that's happening as well. Well, Benjamin Dominick, you're with you're the publisher of The Federalist. What is that? Is that sort of a, is that targeted to the millennials, or is it more of a libertarian magazine? What is it?
So The Federalist is a web magazine. We launched a year ago, last week, in fact, and we're we've got a small staff. Molly Hemingway, David Harsanyi, Rob Krasinski, Joy Pullman, and Sean Davis are my colleagues there. And then we have a host of freelancers who write regularly for us, including people like Heather Wilhelm, Rachel Liu, Leslie Loftus, and others. I think that what our real target audience is actually not millennials, though we do have a younger skewing demographic of writers and readers compared to other conservative and libertarian publications. But it's actually, I would say, a publication targeted at sort of the intelligent Tea Partier and the Tea Party mom. We engage a lot with the culture. If you go to our website in the course of a week, you'll see articles that are more focused on things like, you know, Taylor Swift and Emma Watson, on feminism, on child rearing, on, you know, things that are related to the broader culture, not just pop culture, but the way that we conduct our lives, and less sort of the hard-edged political analysis that you see at a lot of the other places that focus more on red meat or on horse race of things. You know, in our time since we've launched, we get about 1.5 million unique readers a month, and are quite happy with that, and we're doing well in terms of a publication. But we've also featured a lot of different stories. I think most prominently right now, we have an ongoing dispute with Neil deGrasse Tyson, the sort of prominent science popularizer, over a number of things, a number of stories that he's told about President Bush and others that just don't happen to be true. We do take on the left occasionally on things, but, you know, really we're about engaging conservatives and libertarians who are interested in the culture, interested in these longer-term issues, and not just in the horse race of who's up and who's down in Washington.
That sounds like fun, and taking on the left. Well, you know, every now and then, libertarians and the left are sort of, you know, they blend together. There's a lot of overlap there. And, you know, since America's founding, Benjamin, there has been a number of consistent strains. There's always been those who want to make government do good. This appears to have been the dominant strain in both parties for the last 100 years or so. Now, what gives you the sense, you're in touch with your target audience, and it sounds, you know, very specific and targeted nicely to them. What gives you the sense that people are moving away from that long-held tradition that government is there to do good?
You know, I think one of the big things that's happened over the past, one of the big changes that's happened over the past 15 years or so, and really something that I think was kind of a seed of the post-Cold War era for the right, is a shift in the way that people have viewed the role of government. And I think it's been prompted in large part by their reaction to the Bush presidency, both positive and negative. And I think that, in a sense, people who, many of whom are social conservatives or people who know the importance of virtue as something that's sustaining for society, really feel like the course that the Bush administration pursued in trying to, particularly on the domestic policy front, was one that actually didn't really work. It didn't really pan out. That includes both the sort of aims of compassionate conservatism and the project that were undertaken along those lines, but also I think the domestic reforms that involved centralization of power in Washington to a greater degree than it did devolving power back to the states and to localities. And I think that in the course of that, I think that a lot of people who just sort of thought of themselves as traditional social conservatives or traditional conservatives generally have reconsidered whether that was really the right approach to use when it came to trying to affect the culture and society. And I think that a lot of them have instead said, well, wait a minute, that maybe the answer is actually in an era of increased centralization. It's not trying to do better social engineering, better, you know, effects of society by sort of twisting the tax code or doing things in different directions. I mean, for instance, just to give you an example, someone like Michelle Bachmann, who, you know, routinely throughout the 2012 election criticized the fact that that such a large portion of Americans weren't paying any income taxes. Well, the reason for that was, of course, that the Republican administration under George W. Bush and the bipartisan aims of both Clinton and Gingrich led to a dramatic expansion of the child tax benefit, things of that nature. So it was actually lots of families who were not paying income taxes because of that reason. And I think that there are a lot of people who basically said, you know, wait a minute, do we want a system of government that is designed to make people more free, understanding that virtue is only meaningful if it's something that is chosen by someone who has liberty to choose it? Or do we want to sort of get into this game where we're always trying to use the same mechanisms of government that the left always wants to use, except use them for good and use them for the cause of helping people? And I think that there are a lot of well-meaning people in the course of the 90s and the early 2000s who embarked on a couple of mistaken efforts to try and affect that. And I think that the backlash to that has come both from fiscal conservatives and from the rise of the Tea Party has been one that basically rejected that approach and said, you know what, we'd actually rather have our liberty. We'd rather keep, let government get government out of the way and keep the money that we have. And guess what? Maybe liberty is actually more compassionate for people than, you know, so-called compassionate uses of government. And I think that that's something that is essentially a libertarian idea, yes. Small L libertarian idea, but one that is also, I think, broadly accepted by constitutional conservatives who basically look at the Constitution as something that we need to get back to and not just something that is out of step with the times. And I think that, you know, in a certain sense, we need to acknowledge that progressivism has really been a force not just on the left but on the right as well. You know, not just from you know, sort of the days of Teddy Roosevelt, but something that's run through a lot of what you might, you know, consider solutions-based approaches to policy. But the effects of that progressivism have often been negative, and I think that that's often, you know, it's undertaken under the aims of helping people, but it tends to backfire. And I think a great example of this is that something like the Obamacare Medicaid expansion. Medicaid, of course, is an enormous entitlement program. It doesn't actually deliver on its promise in terms of providing people with the medical care they need. But in terms of the Obamacare expansion, rather than being something that's targeted to the types of people within society that conservatives have always been willing to support, despite what the left might say about them, such as, you know, the widow, the orphan, the single mom or people who are truly disabled, it actually really puts on a ton of people who are childless adults who have nothing wrong with them, who have no disability, who simply aren't earning enough money or aren't working enough to be higher on the income scale. And Obamacare, you know, slams all these people into the program. For instance, take a look at a state like Indiana, where Governor Mike Pence is obviously someone who has been a true conservative in the past. It certainly was in Washington, where he voted against No Child Left Behind and things of that nature. But now in Indiana, he's trying to make the Medicaid expansion work, an expansion that would add more than 250,000 of those single, childless, able-bodied, working adults to a permanent entitlement program. And I think that traditional constitutional conservatives look at that as, hey, that may sound compassionate, but it's actually not good in the long run. And it traps people in the program, it disincentivizes their success, it puts them in a position where, you know, if they get offered another $1,000 or $2,000 for a raise, that they should actually reject it because they want to stay on that government program. And that's something that has been, I think, something that both libertarians and true constitutional conservatives have criticized for ages. It's people who, I think, fall into that compassion trap, who go down the road of expanding government and expanding government's role in our lives. And I think that's really where the backlash has been against. It's been something that has allied constitutional conservatives and libertarians. Against.
It's good to hear you talking about virtue. I'm certainly of the left, and I think virtue and that focus has been left out by left and right for way, way, way too long. And you obviously know some history. I of course, disagree with some, I mean, the real entitled, the real, you know, drain on our resources is, of course, the super rich and the big corporations. The welfare people are not even a drop in this huge, huge ocean. However, we'll go beyond that. We're going to talk about libertarians and the millennials, you know, and you talk about, you know, the philosophies of centralized power versus devolution of power. And you and I both looked at what the South was, and, you know, the old South is still alive, and, you know, they've long argued for authority devolving back to the states. Now, if millennials are now enthused about such ideas, as many seem to be, where do they get this? What makes them oppose Washington power? Are they familiar with the Southern rhetoric? Is that, you know, the devolution of power? Is that gaining some new strength?
You know, I think it's actually a completely different source, and I think that one of the things that we can probably agree on is that, you know, if there's one thread that's running through all these polls that indicate millennial opinions, it's a distrust of large institutions, particularly government. So they're within all the poll data, and this is not just true of millennials, but it's more true of them than it has been of other generations. You see that the closer the government is to the people, the more they're likely to trust it. And the
yes.
further away it is, the more they're likely to distrust it.
Right.
I think that the reason for that is a pretty simple one, which is that the further away things are, the more they are likely to be warped by the great sort of powers and interest groups, as opposed to being responsive to what people actually want. And I think that that's something that, you know, has been true historically, and is now even more true in an era when, you know, you have a Wall Street bailout culture. You have a situation where the 1% is doing great in this economy, and everybody else down below is experiencing wage stagnation
right.
and real challenges in terms of their careers and job growth. And I think that what they look at there is, hey, you know, the people who are at the top, the people who have the armies of lobbyists,
right.
accountants, and everybody else, both corporate and interest groups, they get what they want out of this government.
Mm.
They get it from Washington. You know, K Street gets what they want, or this is the way that they've been perceiving it. And I think that this has led to a populist backlash,
mm-hmm.
the left and the right, that basically says this is ridiculous. This is not a government that's interested in the needs of the people. And I think that that's, you know, something that, you know, in the past, the right has just sort of accepted. I mean, compare the way that the right accepted No Child Left Behind, the way they're reacting
yes.
to Common Core.
Good point.
Is obviously something that's being pushed by Jeb Bush and is another example of. But there, I think they're allied with teachers unions on the left as well, who basically have said, wait a minute, this isn't actually a good thing, and,
right.
and these standards don't make sense, and they're designed by.
Oh, it's a terrible problem.
And not responsive to the people.
Yeah.
So, you know, essentially the way I view it is it's less about Southern rhetoric. It's less about kind of the old, like, Tenth Amendment rhetoric that people really think about it in those terms. I think about that they think about it in the same terms that they think about the meals that they eat. We've seen the rise of localism as being, you know, an amazing force in that sort of area. And I think that a point where you say, well, I want things locally grown, and I want things to be available to me that are, you know, that are both, you know, from the international global economy, but also, you know, I want to support my community. I want to be a part of a community. I want to be a part of a neighborhood. And we can't
yes.
do a better job of running things and producing things than people who are far away. And I think that, you know, if you think about it in those terms, the government that we have from Washington is kind of it's the flash frozen fish that you're buying in the middle of America. You know,
chemically treated, yeah.
It's not the locally grown produce. And
right.
I think that people, you know, in the millennial generation, want more of that because they are used to having the institutions that they like the best are the ones that are most responsive to their demands and that are not far off or controlled by other people. And I think that that's something that, you know, is really the motivation here, as opposed to that old school Southern rhetoric that you mentioned.
Yeah, Well, if you just tuned into the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today at this half hour is Benjamin Dominick, publisher of The Federalist. We're talking about the millennials and small L libertarianism. And I have to say, I think my generation has been in favor of localization, keeping it local, you know, keeping decision making close to home, giving ourselves. Yeah, but we sort of dropped the ball, and the Democratic Party, man, they are missing this populist trend, you know, of trying to keep decision making close to the people who are affected by the decisions. Democrats should be glomming onto that. But aside from Bernie Sanders, they're basically nut. And I think it's a huge mistake. And the Republican Party is there with people like, say, for example, Rand Paul, who seems to be connecting with a lot of the millennials, that big generation. And I wonder, Benjamin, about a lot of young people have seen, say, for example, what happened in Ferguson, where, and as an example, it's just the tip of the iceberg of this amazing, shocking militarization of our domestic police, treating us as the enemy, rather than being there as public servants. I wonder if that's connecting with young people, if that's an issue that might be motivating some of the millennials, and if somebody talks about it, perhaps it might connect.
I think you're absolutely correct. In the past, I've said that, if you want to just sort of use a Rorschach test to determine whether someone's a conservative or a libertarian, ask what they think about cops. But I think that overwhelmingly, people have shifted over the course of the past few years to being very skeptical of these, sort of overly armed, overly equipped police forces. There's a line from Homer that, the iron itself incites to deeds of violence. And I think that that's really the sort of situation that we're seeing right now in a case where, a lot of these police forces are equipped with these weapons and these overly armed equipment that really, I think, is something that they want to justify the use of. And so when they roll out to serve a warrant or something along those lines, they end up using something that, ends up creating clashes and a real attitude among the citizenry that leads to distrust and that leads to further violence. And I think that millennials are very skeptical of that. I think they're also very skeptical of the security state. I think many of them, really thought that, President Obama was going to be someone who... was interested in keeping in defending their privacy and in the arguments over the Patriot Act and everything else that came with that. Yeah. I think that they expected him to take a different stand than he did, and I think that the difference generationally between an older generation that doesn't live every day 100% of the day on the internet. Is one that does, is very telling in the sense that I think that they really do believe that, there's definite risks there, and they don't trust the government to be doing anything other than spying and invading their lives. And I think that all of this kind of comes together to coalesce around an idea of, these are institutions that have seized roles within our lives that we never intended for them to have.
Absolutely.
We want them to serve us. We want them to protect us.
Right.
But they don't need to violate our privacy. They don't need to militarize. They don't need to scale up to this level in order to do so. And I think that that's a concept that is really of interest to millennials, and it's something that they've responded to. I think that Republicans are only, with the exceptions of Rand Paul, Mike Lee, and a handful of others, they're only just waking up to this, and I think that those who are more responsive to these challenges are the ones who are getting more of a younger backers. I mean, you look at the primary that happened most recently, between Justin Amash and a Chamber of Commerce backed candidate in Michigan, and that primary ended up going in the way of Amash, and one of the most strongly libertarian Republicans in Congress. I think that's a good example of a source where you have the internal powers of Washington, targeting people within the party who they view as a problem because they speak out on these issues, because they break with the rest of the herd. And the question really is whether the party as a whole is going to shift toward these people who are targeting millennials, or whether they're going to kind of double down on their old way of doing things, which is far more comfortable for any party to do.
So I've noticed, and I fault Democrats quite loudly on this, because if you get somebody like Hillary Clinton, same old, they're not going to criticize the militarization of police and concentration and centralization of power. And there's a lot of people here, as you said at the beginning of the discussion, this is the biggest blip or boom in of generations. And if Republicans and Democrats don't latch onto this, I can't believe they don't do that. But I guess it's maintaining their sense of power. And let me ask you, Benjamin, how much of the young people's attraction to this libertarian ideal is the desire to end the failed prohibition of marijuana? That must be a part of it, I think. I mean, maybe they don't talk about it.
It is absolutely a part of it, though I think it's somewhat exaggerated how much of a part of it it is.
Uh-huh.
If we look at like the behavior of millennials, for instance, even though they overwhelmingly favor legalization,
of course,
they are actually, in terms of their own drug use, they actually are a little more clean living than you might think. So I think that's another example where they really just view it more in terms of these people should not be punished for these crimes to the degree that they are, and nonviolent, the general attitude is nonviolent drug offenders, are not the kind of people who we should be imprisoning.
Yeah.
They're the kind of people who, if they have a real problem, they should be getting treatment, they should be decriminalized, that kind of thing. And that to me is a good indication of kind of where millennials are at versus where kind of the Republican establishment has been, where they've had the attitude that, well, the reason we don't have a crime wave is because we locked up all of these low-level drug offenders and that kind of thing. And
yeah.
It's another good example of how Republicans, that's a good example of how they use social engineering to achieve their end, that millennials, I think, are also rejecting. And then I think also libertarians and a lot of social conservatives are rejecting as well. I mean, just to give you one example of this, there's someone who's, social conservatives like Mike Gerson or Pete Wehner or people like that who worked in the Bush administration, worked in the Bush White House, strongly make the case that drug legalization is a bad thing. Bill Kristol's made the case, that kind of thing.
Mm.
The flip side of that is, people like George Will and others on the right who have moved toward decriminalization or legalization, because basically what they said is, hey, wait a minute, what we've actually been doing is we've been locking up all of these young African-American nonviolent mm-hmm. drug offenders who, if we hadn't locked them up, would probably be marrying the mothers of their children, forming families, living, more productive lives, and that kind of thing. Instead, we've stuck them into a spiral where they become convicts and then they can't get a job. And, we've really, ruined things. Isn't it worse to sort of contribute to the breakdown of family and institutions and things of that nature in the long run? Is it really such a threat of nonviolent drug offenses at this low level that we need to treat them this way? And so I think that there are conservatives who have listened to the libertarian critique to a degree on that score. And I'm curious to kind of see what happens over the coming years as more people open up to this. Again, I think this is an example where localism is something that I think people are increasingly preferring.
Absolutely,
if you want to live in a place where this is legal, if you want to be in a place where this is legal, you should be able to do so. And if you don't, then you shouldn't have to. And I think that's something that people are really, especially in the millennial generation, considering as more valuable.
Well, very, very interesting. I think there's a huge, huge potential here that both Democrats and mainstream Republicans are just missing. Thank you for being with us today. Benjamin Domenech, how can people look at The Federalist?
The Federalist is at thefederalist.com, and they can sign up for our email update there. And, I welcome your listeners to sort of check us out. And thanks again for having me on.
All right. Thanks very much. And we'll be talking about this as time goes on. Kids, ah yes, young people, millennials, there's a lot of them, and they care about freedom. And I think an awful lot of us care about freedom. And in the last segment, we were talking about the militarization of police and just locking up people, breaking up families for small drug violations in this unbelievable failed prohibition against specifically against marijuana. People, average people, I think, are waking up to it. The question is, how far behind the public are politicians? Well, the public in many states come this November 4th are going to have a say on it. They actually are. We don't need to necessarily wait for our leaders to follow us. We can take the lead ourselves. What a concept! Actually, self-governing. Well, I'm very pleased to have with us on this segment Stephen Gutwillig, Deputy Executive Director for Programs of the Drug Policy Alliance, the nation's leading organization working to promote alternatives to the failed war on drugs. Stephen Gutwillig, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
And you write, it may be an off-year election, but it's a big one for drug policy reform. And all, you know, all the attention is going to the people who are spending a gazillion dollars plastering everything on the TV. But this is going on, and there's some degree of hope, dare I say, dare I use that word. You know, the drug war has known to have been a total and terribly wasteful future for many, many years. Stephen Gutwillig, what makes you think there may be real movement this November? How many states and cities have voter initiatives on the ballot?
Well, it's exactly as you say, Bert. Reform is breaking out all over, and citizens are taking reform into their own hands. And seven states, at least 17 different cities and counties around the country, and one U.S. territory, Guam, will have drug policy reform measures on their ballots November 4th. The vast majority of those are specifically reforming marijuana laws, including two states, Oregon and Alaska, that are expected to follow in the footsteps of Colorado and Washington in 2012 and fully legalize marijuana for adult use and set up regulatory systems.
Wow. Well, tell us, I'm rather curious here, you know, here we are in New Hampshire, which is the House of Representatives here actually did pass a full legalization bill, but the Senate, in all its wisdom, crushed it. And, of course, the governor is opposed to it. And it seems most politicians have all the backbone of grilled cheese when it comes to this. They're running with their tails between the leg, you know, just terribly afraid of this. But the people, you know, you talk to average people, most people are there. Tell us about, specifically, let's start with Measure 91 in the state of Oregon.
Well, Measure 91 in Oregon is like the one in Alaska, which is known as Measure 2. They're very much in the spirit of the initiatives that were passed, particularly in Colorado, Colorado's Amendment 64, which has been in full implementation for the last year, which basically say, okay, you know, enough is enough. We have to control marijuana in a different way and take this enormous underground economy and bring it under the rule of law, and acknowledging that marijuana, whether we like it or not, is a mainstream recreational drug, and that probably the best way to manage it, including decreasing access among young people who have near universal access to marijuana and have for decades, the best way to do that is to regulate it along the lines of the way we regulate cigarettes and alcohol. So these two measures in Oregon and Alaska would do just that. They would legalize possession and cultivation of small amounts of marijuana by adults 21 and over, and then they would charge the state government with creating a system to license marijuana growers and wholesalers and retailers as they see fit at the state level.
Well, one of the things that was looked at here in the state of New Hampshire is the enormous potential for tax revenue, a real, pardon me, pot of gold that could happen. In Oregon and Alaska, is there taxation as part of it?
There are. They have different tax schemes, and the ones that are currently in place in Washington and Colorado are different from one another, and this is one of the tricky pieces of this kind of reform, because as your listeners may know, there is no model anywhere in the world that's up and running. These two states were the first jurisdictions anywhere in the world to remove marijuana entirely from the criminal justice system and then create a legal market for it. So what we're going to be seeing over the course of the next couple of years as more and more states take this on is experimentation with the tax model. There are a number of different ways of doing it, all of which will generate substantial new forms of revenue, and you know there'll be different decisions made about at what point in the chain the marijuana that's made legal for adults to buy will be taxed, how much revenue gets generated, and where that revenue is focused. These first round of initiatives tend to focus the revenue on two different things, K-12 education and for drug and alcohol treatment.
Yeah.
In order to obviously create some kind of logical nexus in much the same way that tobacco taxes have been used to decrease the impact of smoking on public health.
And if you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest for this segment is Stephen Gutwillig, who is with the Drug Policy Alliance. We're talking about something that isn't talked about much in the face of all these candidates pushing themselves, alternatives to the failed war on drugs that is in the hands of the people this November 4th. Now, in California, there was an initiative a few years ago that was crushed. I mean, I don't know how close it came, but there was a tremendous amount of pressure and pushback against the legalization of marijuana. What can you tell us about that political dynamic in both Oregon and Alaska?
Well, at this point, there really isn't much opposition. And the
really?
One that you're referring to in California, which was Proposition 19 in 2010, actually did quite well, given that there were no major national reform organizations behind it. It was really largely a local effort with very little funding other than the money that was raised to get it on the ballot. It got nearly 47% of the vote. There was a significant rhetorical campaign against it by former governors, by the attorney general, and sort of others who rattled cages of the voters about that and made dire predictions, and it still got nearly 47% of the vote, which was enormously encouraging to reform advocates around the country. And as we saw only 2 years later, the voters of Colorado and Washington adopted their marijuana legalization initiatives by 55% of the vote, with Colorado's Amendment 64 actually getting 50,000 more votes than President Obama did, who won that state. In Oregon and Alaska, at this point, we're seeing the usual suspects, which is the law enforcement lobby, which is the organizations of sheriffs and police chiefs and sometimes narcotics officers associations, which don't generally have an enormous amount of money, but they'll put some amount of money up against initiatives that they perceive as soft on crime. What you never really hear are the rank and file officers, who certainly tend to recognize that the mass arrests of low-level marijuana possession offenders is a terrible use of scarce law enforcement resources, and you rarely hear rank and file cops say that they think it's a good use of their time. And this is a fairly widespread phenomenon around the country. I mean, your listeners may not realize that of the something like 1.7, 1.8 million drug arrests that occur in the country every year, half of them are specifically related to marijuana alone. And of those, 80-90% of all marijuana-related arrests are for possession of relatively tiny amounts for personal use. And
that's
double, triple the number of arrests in this country every year for all violent crimes combined.
Whoa, that's an amazing statement there. That's double or triple all the arrests for actual violent crime?
That is just marijuana.
Wow.
Right? So it is, the mass arrests of low-level marijuana possession offenders is, it's the single largest category of arrests in New York City. It's the single largest category of arrests of all kinds of drug crimes. And this is why many, many Americans have decided that not just that the war on drugs is a colossal failure. Polls indicate that upwards of 75% of Americans agree with that, but that marijuana now just needs to be treated in a completely different way. Not only do people feel that we should stop criminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana, but that we actually have to recognize the realities of marijuana as it is today and to stop mythologizing marijuana, though, with all the many years of reefer madness exaggeration that the government has been pumping out, and that marijuana, perhaps, unlike other drugs, is a mainstream recreational drug, as I mentioned, second only to alcohol and tobacco in its in its rates of consumption. And so there's just no putting that toothpaste back in the tube, and that we have to acknowledge that there is an enormous underground economy, that marijuana already plays a huge role in the economies of states all pretty much every state around the country, and that we have to really manage that effectively rather than stick our heads in the sand.
Yeah, do you want to keep it out of control or get it under control? I think most people tend to agree with that. If you just tuned in, we're talking with Stephen Gutwillig about initiatives coming up November 4th. And before we get back to the other specific states, you hear if you decriminalize it or legalize it, then you're sending the wrong message. Now, I can see young people these days, teenagers, have unlimited access to marijuana, absolutely unlimited. And it seems to me young people are smoking way less tobacco than they did when I was a kid, that's for sure. Did we make it illegal? Why, no, we didn't. We could educate young people about that. What about this young people thing? What about that argument? And clearly, as you mentioned, the people who are opposing it in those states of Alaska and Oregon, they have their own interests. I mean, it's CYA, they're saving their jobs, obviously. But and I'm sure people are recognizing that. What about,
Well, Bert, you described it exactly. I couldn't have said it better. I mean, the young people have near universal access to marijuana today. They did 10 years ago. They did 40 years ago.
And that's not a good thing.
The message that we're sending, and this is certainly true, that underage marijuana consumption is not a good idea.
No.
And the younger that you begin consuming any psychoactive substance, including alcohol, substantially increases the chance that you're going to have some problem with it.
Yep.
So everyone has an interest in delaying experimentation, in keeping psychoactive substances away from young people. And what we found in the example that you give in the regulation of cigarettes is a perfect, is the best example. We've done a very, very, very good job of substantially reducing the consumption of cigarettes. Smoking has fallen by well more than half over the last half century among adults, and particularly among young people. We've made it uncool, and we did that. Without arresting tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, without making it illegal. We use the tools that the evidence tells us works within a public health environment. And the same will work for marijuana. The message that we're sending by removing marijuana from the criminal justice system and regulating it along the lines of alcohol and tobacco is this is for adults. That this is a substance that has risks associated with it. Those risks are manageable, but those risks are heightened both when we drive consumption underground and when we don't make a point of keeping it away from young people, which of course is what drug dealers they couldn't care less.
That's
and
right.
They certainly don't. They don't ask for identification the way a well-regulated business will. And there's one of the things that that liquor stores most fear is the possibility of losing their license because they've sold to underage people, and young people consistently indicate that they have a much harder time buying alcohol than they do marijuana.
That's so true. Now, so what are the chances? I want to move on to other states and localities too, which is an interesting question. What do you think the chances of Oregon and Alaska passing these measures are?
they're both actually very good. The polling is as you can imagine, difficult in Alaska, and polls are notoriously incorrect in assessing candidate races in Alaska. So no one ever really knows until election day. But there's quite a lot going on the ballot in Alaska. There's one of the battleground Senate races occurring there. So the turnout is expected to be significant. That helps any kind of reform initiative like this. And so we're fairly optimistic about Alaska and about Oregon. Oregon is, of course, very significant because it's a border state of Washington, which legalized 2 years ago, and California, where we anticipate that there will be a marijuana legalization initiative during the 2016 election.
I'd be surprised if there wasn't. Now, what about these? I mean, this is being recorded in New Hampshire, very close to the Maine border. How can towns make laws that differ from state laws? I know that York County, I believe, has been trying to do something. How does this work?
What they're doing is there are initiatives in York, South Portland, and Lewiston, Maine, which are following in the footsteps of Portland, Maine last year, which passed a voter initiative that very simply eliminated criminal penalties for adult possession within that jurisdiction. You know, so up to an ounce of marijuana. That doesn't preclude state police from enforcing state law any more than the legalization of marijuana prevents the FBI from enforcing federal law within the states that have changed their laws. And this is part of the federalist system that we have, that you are, you know, particularly between the states and the federal government, they're not required to have parallel sets of laws. There are state drug laws, and there's a federal drug law, right. And there are federal drug laws under the Controlled Substances Act. But at the state level and at the local level, there's an enormous amount of discretion by local law enforcement to decide their priorities and what the citizens of these municipalities in Maine, and then, you know, as we'll discuss, you know, all across Michigan, they're basically saying we want marijuana enforcement to be a extremely low, if not non-existent, priority for local law enforcement.
And do talk, please, about Michigan. You mentioned Michigan. What's going
There's
on there?
A really interesting movement within Michigan. A lot of this is, as in Maine, a prelude to what's anticipated to be a statewide initiative to end marijuana prohibition outright there. So in the last couple of years, seven cities in Michigan have removed, similar to Maine, local penalties for adults possessing small amounts of marijuana, in this case in their homes. And as of last week, something like a dozen other cities across Michigan will have initiatives on their ballot November 4th to do the same. And so this is relatively unprecedented across the country. I mean, local activists have been gathering signatures and putting these on the ballots. And so, you know, something like 20 different cities across Michigan will have gone on record saying that they don't think that people should be arrested for possessing small amounts of marijuana. And they're sending a message to elected officials who will eventually take notice of the fact that significant majorities of Americans across lines of race, ideology, gender, and geography are all saying the same thing.
And in Florida, there's probably going to be a high turnout there. There's a hot gubernatorial race. There's something called Amendment 2 there. Why is Florida particularly significant, and that old unbelievable bad guy Sheldon Adelson is playing into it? What's going on in Florida?
Yeah, this is really one to watch. As of now, there are 23 states that have adopted laws, comprehensive systems to regulate marijuana as medicine. Starting in, you know, California in 1996, there's just been a whole spate of laws where we nearly half the states in the country have medical marijuana laws. None of them at this point are in the South. Florida, if Amendment 2 passes on November 4th, will become the first the first southern state, the first first largely red state, although it's obviously a presidential battleground state, but you know, one of the largest states following New York's adoption by the legislature last year, and then of course California 20 years ago. But it'll become one of the largest states, and of course as a bellwether state in American politics, very, very significant if Florida were to adopt a medical marijuana law. I think it would essentially bring an end to the conversation or the debate around the country, especially the question that many elected officials have about the role of marijuana as medicine. It would completely tip that question and resolve any lingering debate about medical marijuana. But as you mentioned, this one is particularly one to watch because for the first time in medical marijuana initiative history, and frankly across all of these campaigns to reform the marijuana laws, there's really never been significant funded opposition. But as you say, a casino mogul Sheldon Adelson, who was a big backer of Republican candidates, particularly Newt Gingrich's presidential bid in 2012, has put more than $2 million into the opposition to this amendment to the Florida Medical Marijuana Initiative, largely because the backers of Amendment 2 are also related to the gubernatorial campaign of former Republican, now Democrat, former Republican Governor Charlie Crist, who's now running as a Democrat in that race. And the backers of Amendment 2 have made it no secret that they believe that medical marijuana is an important reform in its own right to provide this medicine for desperately ill people, but that also they believe that having it on the ballot and has upwards of 70% to 80% support among Floridians will also drive more Democrats to the polls on Election Day and help Charlie Crist's gubernatorial bid.
My goodness, there's been times this election season where I've started to get a little bit depressed, but you're making me feel better, Steve.
No, it's interesting. I mean, this is a momentum election. No one really quite saw the victories in both Colorado and Washington's legalization initiatives coming in 2012. Hmm. But what's happening now is, with seven states and 17 municipalities, opponents of these reforms, but particularly opponents of people who want to keep marijuana illegal and keep marijuana as a criminalized substance, they pretty much have to run the table on November 4th in order for the in order to stop the momentum for reform around the country.
Hmm. So the momentum is continuing. Well, there's your organization, there's the Marijuana Policy Project. How can people, if they want to be supportive, get in touch? I'm sure there's something on those crazy internets where they can get involved.
Well, they can get in touch with Marijuana Policy Project, which does great work around the country. My organization is the Drug Policy Alliance,
right,
which works to make marijuana legal, to treat addiction as a health issue, to end mass incarceration, dramatically reduce the size of the prison population, and to end the drug war overall. And they can learn more about Drug Policy Alliance at drugpolicy.org.
Drugpolicy.org. Interesting times indeed. It seems like momentum is pretty clear. We'll find out November 4th. And please remember to get out and vote, everybody, no matter where you are. Steve Gottwillig, thanks so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
It's a pleasure being with you.
Very interesting. And we'll see, as we discussed in the first half hour, it's about freedom. People want freedom. They don't want this, big, police state looking over their shoulders. They really want freedom, and people understand what freedom is. Hey, let me know how you feel about it. Burt@BurtCohen.com. Thanks very much for listening.
So I bought my lid. Even messing with my children. And you're screaming at my wife. And get off of make me want to get out of here alive.
Freedom!
Freedom! That's what I want now. Drugstore man, well, I don't need it now. I'm just trying to slap it out of her hand.
Freedom,
so I can live.
Freedom,
so I can give.
Freedom,
freedom,
yeah.
Freedom, that's what I need.
Right on.